Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 18 people represent the state of Ohio in the United States Congress. Three of them are women, and two are people of color. African Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population, yet hold only 8% of the seats in Congress. They're on track to make up a third of the population in the next few decades, but Latinos make up just 7% of Congress. Today, we're talking about the barriers to elective office, why more people don't run, and how political parties are trying to change that. Joining us now in the studio is political scientist and retired OSU professor Paul Beck. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be here, Ann.
It's 2014. How are there still so few women and minorities in office?
Well, it takes time. I think the way to think about this is that there are roughly 500,000 elected officials in the United States, most of them at the local level, of course. And you can almost think of this as a pyramid with the offices you talked about at the very peak of that pyramid. People work their way up through it. Many of them fall into the wayside because they don't get elected and so forth. I think most candidates for office are probably recruited. They're asked to run, either by the parties that play a very active role in trying to find people to be candidates for even the lower level offices in communities around the country as community leaders, their local Rotary or Kiwanis Club who are encouraging people to run for office. The other thing is that there are groups that will put money into candidates' races, and it takes money more and more these days and more, of course, as you move to the higher offices. Some people are self-recruited. Many of them are people who have the money to be able to not totally finance a campaign themselves, but help themselves finance a campaign. There are groups out there that recruit and will put votes behind people. The best example recently is the Tea Party, of course, that will identify candidates for office and will pledge to them the support of Tea Party members. Sometimes it's forthcoming, sometimes it isn't, but there's that. And so if you think about this as kind of a recruitment system, it takes time for people to work their way up from the lower levels to the higher levels.
Except when we look at examples such as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Yes. Well, some people have natural advantages. Hillary, of course, married to a president and a governor before that. That was an advantage. Obama's career is interesting, that it was sort of like a meteor. And he was lucky early on that he ran against people on the south side of Chicago and then later for the Senate who weren't very good opponents. And then, of course, once he entered the presidential race, I don't think people a year before the primaries began gave him much chance of winning. But he was the right person at the right time, I think. He, again, is a great counterexample of how somebody to back up for a minute, I never thought in my lifetime an African-American would be president. But there he was at the right time. He proved to be a very able candidate and was elected. So it can happen. But in terms of just the actuarial odds, the odds are pretty much against people unless they have built up this experience, have been able to raise money, have been able to garner the support of particular groups out there. And it just takes time. And you know, women, if you look back 20 or 30 years ago, certainly with African Americans and Hispanics, weren't very much present even at these most local of levels. And that's changing, but it'll take time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Paul Beck. He's a political scientist, retired OSU professor. What he's saying will take time is the ascension of women and minorities to elective office in the United States. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It takes time. It takes resume building.
Yes.
And that takes time.
Yes.
Some years ago, I wrote a column for the Columbus Dispatch about the disparity in appointments to commissions and boards by the governor. And it wasn't just that governor. It had gone back through time. Most of them were men, white males.
Yes.
Those are kind of, and some people said, what difference does it make? And my point was, well, if you're resume building, if you want to work your way up, are those the kind of things you're talking about? Because it seems like the powers that be or the organizations, the bodies of people that recruit tend to recruit people who look like themselves.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they recruit people whom they think can win. But the people they think can win tend to look like themselves. And even though women now, as candidates, probably do every bit as well as men do as candidates, maybe even a tad better, that perception that they aren't going to be winners probably persists in some circles. What's interesting about this is that the states that have the strongest party organizations are the states that have been the most resistant to the rise of women, women in particular, but also probably minorities. And it's because the parties have more control over the recruitment channels than they do in states where the parties are weak and things are kind of wide open. And then people are more, you know, kind of self-nominated candidates or nominated by citizens groups of one kind or another.
When John McCain selected a woman, a female running mate, a lot of feminists were upset about it. They weren't upset that she was female. They were upset that he chose a female such as he did when there's so many able women out there that could have done a better job.
Well, I think he wanted a game changer and felt that Palin was the kind of candidate who could be a game changer. And she was initially. She increased the level of motivation, commitment, intensity among the Republican base. She didn't do well over time among independents and certainly among Democrats. So probably on balance, it was not a good move. But it was early on, and it really energized the McCain campaign.
Was it good for women in general that someone like Sarah Palin ascended in that way at that time?
I think it depends on who you are. There would be a group of women, a group of Americans who are in love with Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. I'd really feel that she speaks straight, out of the heart. They like what she has to say. For them, that was representation that they hadn't had before, even in the Republican Party. I think on balance, though, it may not have been all that beneficial for women, just because she didn't prove to be a highly capable candidate.
A wildly disproportionate number of members of Congress are millionaires.
Yes.
I think that something like 66% of Congress is made up of millionaires who overall represent just 1% of the overall population. So they're not necessarily self-recruited. You have to be really rich to be able to do that without support. But what does that say about our the bodies that rule us and who's recruiting them?
Well, I think that candidates for Congress and sitting members of Congress always, of course, have been far more wealthy or richer than the ordinary Americans.
They were landowners in the beginning.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And you go back to the beginning, that's
true. So it's historical.
I think these days particularly, where campaign funding is so important, what the people who do the recruiting for congressional offices always will ask about a candidate is, can he or she raise money? And if they've got some money to put into it already, that helps. If they're well connected to people who have money, that also helps. What I'm talking about are the congressional campaign committees that are always in the market for good candidates. And they're looking for people who can kind of get over the hump financially and be able to finance a reasonable campaign. And then they'll get help later on.
To what extent is it significant that the system has been developed over history by white males, and that it's not just about whether you're recruited and whether you look like them, but maybe that's not the system women or minorities would develop over time?
Well, I think that's probably right. If we lived in a different society, it could have been white women who were in charge of things. Not likely, but it could have been. And they would have looked for candidates like them. We're most comfortable with people like us. And certainly the white men who were dominating politics for most of American history, all of American history, are going to look first to people they're comfortable with, people who maybe belong to the clubs they belong to. It wasn't so long ago that women were not admitted to some of the social clubs that are very important at the community level in Ohio and many other states. And so I think it's natural to turn to people who you can trust, maybe. You could trust them because they're like you.
Mm-hmm.
and you know they're not going to do things that you wouldn't particularly like, whereas somebody else who is not within that circle of trust, maybe somebody you have some doubts about. Now, that, again, that's changing. But sometimes this kind of change really lags. And I think it lags more in states that are more traditional than states that are full of people who have moved there, for example, without deep local roots, or states that have weak party organizations.
I stand corrected. It's 66% of the U.S. Senate is populated by millionaires, not the entire Congress. Back when I started covering the state legislature 25 years ago, okay, everybody out there, don't start counting.
You were a child.
There were a lot, yeah. I was in swaddling clothes. A lot of the members, particularly in the Senate, but also to a certain degree in the House, were women. Several of them had inherited the offices, if you will, from their husbands who were deceased, or that was a pattern. That's not the case necessarily anymore because of term limits. No one has an office that long where it's by dane of tradition their surviving spouse would take over. But what do you make of the difference, 25 years ago when there were more women in the Senate, I think, in the Ohio General Assembly than there are now?
Well, first, I think Ohio is unusual compared to other states.
How so?
Most states have shown a growth in the percentage of women in the state legislatures. Ohio, for a variety of reasons, has not shown that kind of growth. I think the other thing is that if you think of, for example, governors, there was a time when the only governors in American history who were women were the wives of people who had been governors before.
Same thing.
Think of Ma and Pa Ferguson in Texas. They're the famous example of that. That really has changed. There are now more women governors around who've been elected really on the basis of their own careers and their own resumes rather than any kind of an attachment to a particularly popular male figure.
Greg in Whitehall, you're on the air. Paul Beck is my guest. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I want to ask your guest. He said it takes time. We've come from, obviously, I'm a black male. I've done my time in the Marine Corps. I'm 50 years old, and I've seen a lot of things take place and changes, but he says we need time. How much more time does the African-American male, or female for that matter, need? Because the way I and my friends see it, and I have probably more white friends than black, there's just a lot of prejudice out there, and money, those are the two holding women and most blacks down, is the money aspect. And for some reason, the rich people don't want to accept that. They feel that Obama got in, so it shows we're not prejudiced. That's crap. Most black people even consider Obama black. We never even heard of him until he ran for president. And vote for him, I wanted Hillary to be president.
Okay. Well, let's see what Paul Beck. Something's wrong with your phone, though, Greg. Thanks for calling. Paul Beck,
a little frustration there. I understand the frustration, and it does take time. Sometimes you can push the envelope if you have good candidates around. What we've seen, in fact, most remarkably what we've seen is in the South, where 40 years ago, there, of course, were few African-American voters and certainly no African-American sheriffs. Now, across the South in a variety of counties, are sheriffs who are African-Americans. It took time for that to happen. It took a voting group of African-Americans in those jurisdictions who were willing and very interested in supporting African-American candidates. So it happens. It may happen more slowly than one would like. But again, people can push the envelope. There are recruitment mechanisms around their organizations that are looking for good African-American candidates and finding them and pushing them forward.
I wanted to just follow up real quickly on the point you made that Ohio is different than a lot of states. Why is Ohio different? Is it because of the media markets, the expense of running? It's going to take longer to overcome those roadblocks?
I really don't know why Ohio is different. I mean, the research has shown, again, that states with strong party organizations tend to be states where the number of women in elected offices, particularly at the state legislative level, is a little lower And that may be because the political parties and the white males who have controlled them more or less over time have the recruitment channels more under their control.
Mm-hmm.
States that are more open have been more open to women and minorities. Whether Ohio quite fits, I mean, it does fit that pattern in some ways. On the other hand, as you said, there were more women in the legislature some years ago than there are now. That almost requires a different explanation. It may just be circumstantial. I mean, that could change over time. It'll be interesting to see if we have the emergence of women leaders in the state legislature. We've had them before. I think of Joanne Davidson from you know, this area.
Right.
But as I understand it, there probably are not any right now who are vying for the top leadership positions, and maybe that'll change over time.
Okay. We're talking about the dearth of women and minority candidates and women and minority elected officials in Ohio and at the state and at the national level. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last year, the first Hindu and the first Buddhist were sworn into the 113th United States Congress. Current Congress includes Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Mormons, Muslims, but not a single admitted atheist, even as the population of American nonbelievers continues to grow. Today, we're talking about the barriers to running for elected office and why the average politician often has little in common with many average Americans. Still with us is political scientist and retired OSU professor Paul Beck. Joining us now is the outgoing Franklin County Democratic Party chair, Greg Haas. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Ann.
And by phone, the Republican State Leadership Committee's communications director, Jill Bader. Welcome, Jill.
Hi, thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, I'd move it closer to your mouth. Yeah. Greg Haas, the Associated Press today reported new census data that show working class whites now make up fewer than half of Ohio's eligible voters, a demographic change that has both parties expanding their efforts to reach other voters. You told the reporter in that article that Ohio is too balanced for either party to ignore any segment of voters. How does that translate to the candidates that are recruited by the party, as you see it over your long career?
Sure. I think both parties actually have been more ahead of this than a lot of people realize. I mean, I go back to when I was working with the local party back in the early 80s, and we had a very strong recruiting effort aimed at minorities and women. You know, you mentioned in the earlier segment the impact of Sarah Palin, but there was a very huge impact with Geraldine Ferraro when Walter Mondale picked her.
A Democratic candidate.
Yep, Emily's List formed out of that. There was the first recognition of gender gap voting and how that benefited Democrats. And as a result, you know, here in Columbus, you know, we have, you know, at one point very recently, we had three women commissioners. Tracy Hurd, the minority leader of the House, is from Columbus. We have an African-American mayor. We've had a strong African-American representation on city council and the school board for quite a long period of time. And Columbus is a still a majority white community. Columbus's numbers are very similar to state numbers demographically. We're a lot younger than the rest of the state, but that's the main distinction between us and most of the other demographics. So we've been working on this for a long time. I think when you talk about the barriers, though, what I really see are more of the self-imposed barriers. I don't think the parties have the same flexibility that a lot of people think in terms of just going out and picking candidates. You've really got to go to people who've expressed a strong interest, shown a desire, and are really driven, because it's such a it's a monstrous process. It's very, very difficult to run for office at any level. And so, you know, what we've seen over the years, the simple truth is that I think for both parties, There are more white men who step up to that. And what we've all made an effort, I think both parties have, and we certainly have made an effort to break down those barriers in lots of ways.
Like, could you give me an example of how you...
Well, fundraising. You know, fundraising is a very difficult, it's a degrading process. People look at it like, you know, there's several things wrong with the influence of money in politics, but one of them is just on the impact it has on potential candidacies, that people do not want to sit in a call room for 5 or 6 hours a day begging people with extra money for contributions. Most people don't want to do that. But to be a successful candidate, that's one thing you have to be willing
to
do.
In the system that's in place today.
Yeah.
Jill Bader, thoughts? How does it translate? How do these numbers translate into the candidates that the Republican Party puts forward?
Well, you know, I think Greg and I can probably don't agree on a whole lot of things, but we do agree on this, that our parties and our elected representation needs to better reflect the full diversity of America. And what we do at the Republican State Leadership Committee is we have something called the Future Majority Project, which is a sustained effort. It's been a three-year, it's been going on for the past 3 years, where we are recruiting, training, and supporting first-time candidates of diverse ethnicity across the country. Our goal this year was 200 first-time Republican candidates to run at the state level. We surpassed that goal. We now have 244 first-time candidates, six of whom are in Ohio. And then our Right Women Right Now initiative is a similar program as part of the Future Majority Project to recruit, train, and support at least 300 first-time women. And we're proud that we have over 500 women that we have worked with, party officials on the ground, in state houses across the country, the leadership, elected leadership of the parties, and we're very proud about it. We're excited, and we're working to make sure that not only did we get these men and women to put their name on the ballot, but now we're working to try to help them get over the finish line.
So of those first-time candidates mm-hmm. that you referred to, how can you give us a demographic breakdown?
Well, we have mostly Hispanic candidates. About half of our candidates are of Hispanic descent, followed by African-American candidates. And then we have candidates depending upon what part of the country. For example, in Montana, we have three Native American candidates. So we have candidates of all different backgrounds that are working with us to try to, you know, make sure that our party better reflects what America looks like today.
Unpublished 2014 census figures show about 4.1 million or 48% of eligible voters in Ohio are working class whites. That's down from 50.5% from 2 years ago. The reporter wrote that in response to those figures, Democrats are trying to paint themselves as the party of diversity with a 2014 statewide ticket that features three white men, two white women, and one black woman. And that Republicans, meanwhile, are trying to reach more female voters and college students as they try to widen their appeal. Greg Haas, is that the sort of thing that drives the makeup of, say, a statewide ticket?
No, I mean, I want to go back to the kind of the point about the self-imposed thing, because those barriers are the single biggest factor. And parties, you know, even the strongest parties in the country, and I've worked with a lot of them over the years, are weak when it comes to their ability to actually convince people to run for office. And it's dangerous and high risk. I mean, one of the things that both parties do is, you know, we do a lot of things to encourage people to step forward themselves and self-identify. But a great story about this that I always tell people, when Dick Celeste was leaving the governor's office, a good mutual friend of ours, Ann Lisa Brown, and I had been working for Mary Ellen Withrow for a number of years. And Mary Ellen was thinking about possibly running. And we go over to the governor's office, and there's four of us there, and there's one chair, empty chair at the front. And Mary Ellen just kind of, we have a great conversation, but then Mary Ellen says to Dick, you know, what do you think I need to do to be elected governor? And Dick said, it'll be very simple. It's very simple. All you have to do is one thing. You just have to be willing to eat that chair. You know, what he meant by that is do what it takes.
Okay.
You know, I mean, grind it out and do what it takes. We walked into the hallway and Mary Ellen says, I don't think I want to eat a chair.
Was also at the end of her own career.
Well, that was before she went to U.S. Treasurer.
That's true.
And she had just led the ticket. You know, she was, you know, so anyway, I, the, the thing about it is that you have to have, particularly to move to that next level, that kind of, you know, you can, you know, show my age here with a, but you can have a kind of Johnny Bench skill, but if you don't have Pete Rose drive, you're not going to be successful in politics.
Jill Bader, I was going to bring this up in the next segment, but I'll say it now. The U.S. ranks 98th in the world for the percentage of women in the legislature. We were talking earlier about the system and how the system, as if the system is immovable, as if the system can't be changed. Is there something about our system that differs from other countries where more women clearly are elected to office by far?
Well, I think it's a variety of different things. And one thing that we work very strongly with Right Women right now is encourage people to ask women in their communities to run. I saw an interesting statistic once where about 40% of qualified women consider themselves somebody that should run for office, and about 60% of qualified men consider themselves somebody should run for office. But then when you ask a man, and when you ask the woman, at equal 70%, they consider running. And so, you know, what we encourage not only the women elected officials that we work with across the country, but also the men elected officials to say, you know, a wonderful, smart, outstanding woman candidate who you think should run, encourage her, ask her, tell her that she would be great. You know, I read another statistic where a woman needs to be asked on average 7 separate times before she actually considers putting her name on the ballot. And you know, I think there's a variety of reasons culturally why we've gotten to that point. But I think that the way that we are interacting with our women candidates is changing. I think that there's an overwhelming amount of support, especially in our state houses across the country, for us to say we need more women. How do we find women in our communities? We've been doing something called diversity in business roundtables in different areas where we know we're going to have across the country open seats in the state legislative bodies, where we're seeing where there's density of minority communities as well as women business owners, having interactions with them to try to find candidates, not just for this cycle, but for cycles in the future.
Well, you said there's probably reasons for that women don't do it. What are those reasons?
Well,
they don't want to eat the chair.
Well, I've never been told to eat a chair before. But
you know what we're talking about. Usually it has to do with money.
Yes. Well, it has to do with money. I think that, you know, traditionally women have had, less opportunities to climb the corporate ladder, less of the good old boys club, less opportunities to start climbing their own careers, whether it's in elected office, whether it's in corporate America. We see there's less women on boards of directors. And I do think that right now is the best time in the history of the planet to be a woman considering running for office, because people want women. They're excited to find great women candidates and looking for ways to support them. As part of our Future Majority Project last cycle, we spent $5 million supporting women and diverse candidates across the country. We expect to be on par with that this year. We're very excited about the crop of women that we have found and diverse candidates as well. And I think that both parties, and I'm sure Greg would agree, when we find an outstanding candidate, we're trying to find other ways to help them, whether it's through trainings. We put women and our diverse candidates in a mentorship program where they have opportunities to talk to people that have gone through the process before, who can help guide them through the process. We have online trainings, and offering that additional level of support, I think, makes a huge difference.
Paul Beck?
Both of my colleagues here have mentioned some of the barriers that are around for women and minorities as well, and I'd like to focus with women particularly in mind on two of them. One is that in our society still, there are differences in gender roles when it comes to child rearing. And women are typically more responsible for the children in the family. It's very hard to run for office with young children at home. And I think over time that barrier may be lowered, but it's still there. The second one is that a lot of candidates for office are people who come from professional or business positions that allow them to balance a political career with the money-earning capacity they have through their business or profession. Lawyers are the most famous in that regard. Insurance agents and so
Farmers.
Forth. Women are less likely, even today, though the numbers are growing, to be in those kinds of careers. I also think of situations. I was thinking the other day about Mitch Daniels, who was the governor of Indiana. Mitch Daniels worked for the Bush administration. He came back to Indiana. Eli Lilly hired him as basically governor in waiting. He worked for Eli Lilly, but they saw him as somebody with great political potential. In a way that maybe Lehman Brothers saw John Kasich in Ohio. And so there's also a tendency for business organizations to, quote, stockpile, end quote, candidates who can be bridged between maybe an earlier political career and a later political career at a higher level. And that may begin to change with women as well, but I think women are not as advantaged in that way.
Okay, well, I want to thank Jill Bader, Communications Director for the Republican State Leadership Committee, for joining us today. Jill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And also Greg Haas, outgoing Franklin County Democratic Party Chair. Greg, thanks for your insights.
Thank you very much.
We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. ranks 98th in the world for the percentage of women in the legislature. Women make up more than 50% of the U.S. population, but just 19% of Congress. And that's a record high. So what are we missing out on? Studies show that female lawmakers introduce more bills related to civil rights, education, and health than their male counterparts. And a female head of state correlates to higher GDP growth in diverse nations. We're talking today about the barriers to candidacy, why more women and minorities don't run for office, and what's being done to encourage more diversity among candidates. Still with us is political scientist and retired OSU professor Paul Beck. And joining us now from New York is the executive director of Vote Run Lead. That's a nonpartisan organization that trains women for civic leadership. Welcome to the show, Erin Velarde.
Thank you.
The U.S. ranks just behind Kenya and Indonesia in terms of female representation in the legislature. Have you looked at these numbers? Is this something you study? Can you tell us what's going on, Erin?
Absolutely. And this number is not new, unfortunately.
Right.
And when we look at our history, even in the states, we've been at this 20-25% number at the state legislature for about 20, you know, some odd years.
Right.
And that stagnation is why we need a real massive effort. We need more than just a few women running at a time because, you know, we have term limits. We have, you know, a political life cycle is only so long. No one's going to stay in the legislature or, you know, the Congress, you know, a few will. But, you know, ideally we're getting fresh candidates every time. So we have to really ratchet it up as a country and encouraging women at a much larger scale than we're doing now. And, you know, your previous guests, everyone's trying to go after women, but it has to be done with such vigor and with such large numbers to really put a dent in, you know, this low numbers of representation.
I keep going back to the system and that when you have a door that opens one way and you have different creatures that enter in different ways, you're never going to get that except for the exceptions that prove the rule.
Exactly. And actually, There's a couple of groups working on the systemic stuff. You know, how do you have multi-member districts that allow for more diversity, not just gender, but
tell us what a multi-member district is. I mean,
well,
it sounds obvious, but
sure. So there's a great organization called Fair Vote, and they have a project called Represent 2020 that more than just a multi-member district, where you know you have essentially large numbers of folks running for the same seat. And so you don't have the problems with districts where you have a particular population that may vote in a particular way. So it adds for the likelihood of different kinds of voices being heard and will allow folks to, you know, it opens up the process, and that's what we're talking about. I think Senator Schumer has something in the New York Times this week about opening up the process by changing our primary system. There are a variety of ways, actually systemic change, that allow for more diverse and representative candidates.
Paul Beck, you mentioned earlier it takes time. What if the system started to change?
Well, there are systemic properties that I think lead to the kind of situation that we have right now. The comparison with other countries, for example, comes down to a variety of things. But one of them is that most of those political systems have what is called a party list, where the party will put together a set of candidates. They will try to balance that ticket, increasingly to put more women there, or minorities for that matter, depending on the particular country's kinds of minorities. But the party's in control of that. And then the people who are elected are people who you just go down the party list from top to wherever you get to the vote level that you've gotten in that particular district. And many of these are multi-member districts. And so it gives the party more control over that. Now, it sounds almost contradictory to what I said before, because strong American parties often have been resistant to women candidates or minority candidates because they like people like themselves, at least their leaders do. But a party list would give them the advantage to balance a ticket. And I think these days parties are very interested in balancing the ticket. Not only are women a majority of the population, they're a clear majority of voters. And so there's a real target there that's important. And of course, African Americans and Hispanics in many states make up a critical swing group or a group that can elect candidates to office. And so you want to make sure that you have them, you know, members from those communities on your ballot as well as a party. But there's a tendency sometimes, particularly where parties are strong, to offer them up almost as sacrificial lambs. They're on the ticket, but there's not an expectation that they're going to get elected there. We need to see a change so that there is the expectation that they're going to get elected. They'll be able to raise the kind of money they need to raise and get the kind of party backing they need to get elected.
And when you're saying that, you're saying, like, say it's a big Republican year like we have coming up. The Democratic ticket is, they don't, maybe they're not, they're putting out some sacrificial lambs because they're not going to get elected anyways, and it gives them some exposure, building block type stuff, and vice versa.
Well, I think the Democrats, particularly in Ohio, recognize that their base is a very diverse base, and they've got to represent that base, or the base, or at least certain parts of it, will begin drifting away from them. And so they do that, and they do that more or less automatically. The Republican base is not as diverse. It may be diverse ideologically in some ways, but it's not diverse in terms of ethnic or gender background, and so they're going to be less representative of that. African-American candidates, for instance, in statewide races in Ohio have not done well at all, and both parties recognize that.
Aaron Villar,
but, and this this goes back to my earlier point that it's not a real, true effort around recruiting women. I think it is. There's a real effort around going after women voters. I think there's real efforts around, showcasing the women that are currently in each of the parties. But in going out at the local and national levels and recruiting women to run for office is simply not happening by the parties, not at a rate that's ever going to change these numbers. So you see it in the sacrificial lamb. You know, that's where it kind of manifests itself the worst. But we have to do this for ourselves. We have to encourage women in a different way outside of the party structure so that we don't wait, several hundred years for real results.
We have an email from a listener who brings up an issue. Writes, Franklin County local politics is still based on traditional forms of engagement, working campaigns, hanging signs, stuffing envelopes, etc. If you don't do grunt work first, you are not considered. Recruiting efforts for candidates have not kept up with the changes in the information age. Aaron Villardi, what do they mean by that from where you sit?
I think that I agree, especially around the information age. And something that we are doing as part of the organization Vote Run Lead is actually creating a really easy tool online to recruit women to run so that you can encourage women via your social networks and your emails and get them connected to resources. Because, oftentimes a busy mom might not have a couple of hours each week to give. There has to be other ways for folks to volunteer besides the face-to-face grunt work. There has to be other ways for folks to cut their political teeth and build their civic resumes besides, the traditional route of paying your dues, as the caller wrote in. Mm-hmm. We've got to create more avenues to politics, and those opportunities are about access. So if you're not giving women opportunities that fit their lifestyles or their skill set, right? They may be very technologically savvy and may be able to do other things besides stuff envelopes, you know, that allows them to cut their political teeth.
John and Galena, you are on the air. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for your guest, Paul. He mentioned that states with open systems typically see higher instances of success with women and minorities. What are the states that are open doing differently than states that have strong party systems?
Well, I think the difference is that states that are more open have more open access to candidacies, where the parties kind of control the channels in the states with strong party organizations. The party organizations, where they're strong, can throw all kinds of resources behind a candidate, not only money and the ability to raise money, to make the contacts to raise money, but also campaign workers and volunteers who will work for a particular candidate. In more open states, the party simply doesn't sit astride those channels as importantly, and so it kind of opens up the gates a bit more for women there, sometimes mm-hmm. substantially more.
Thanks, John. What about gerrymandering, the art of drawing districts to benefit one political party or the other? Aaron Velarde, has that been an issue? Of course, it's a very strong force in the state of Ohio. Nationally, have you seen that play out?
Absolutely. The trend is the same there. And just as the professor is saying, you know, when you keep those systems, you create those rules and draw those lines that allow for essentially what's called safe seats. There's no incentive to run against that person that is, you know, an incumbent or 99% likely that, you know, these drawn lines are, you know, all Republican or all Democratic and vote a certain way. So it takes essentially the fairness out of the game by drawing those lines and thus keeping seats not competitive. And so you either have to get up and move somewhere to another district so that you're in a competitive race, or probably run three or four times to put a dent in, you know, a 96% incumbent rate, you know, where that person's going to get reelected. So it really de-incentivizes folks to run for office and keeps the process in a, you know, just as the previous caller wrote in, you know, the folks who have paid their dues behind what is most likely a certain gentleman will be the next person right behind him. And so it keeps the infrastructure and the access to that seat very in line with party politics.
Gerrymandering has become a huge force. It's always been a force, Paul Beck, in Ohio. But you couple that with term limits, and which was envisioned as a way, as a gateway for more women and minorities. It's been exactly the opposite. Is that part of the issue as well?
I think gerrymandering is a factor there, probably a small factor.
Okay.
But it certainly is there. And what it does is create safe seats. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing more recently is that it moves competition into the primaries. Because of that, money becomes even more important. And I want to come back to money because I think that you know, we've reached a time in this country where money is more important in campaigns than it probably ever has been, at least the ability to raise money. Whether it translates into votes is another question, but every candidate realizes they need to raise a lot of money. Women have trouble raising that money at the critical time early in a campaign when they need it. There's an organization that we've already talked about a bit called Emily's List. Mm-hmm. And it's an acronym, Emily, is for Early Money is Like Yeast. And the idea there was that Emily's List could raise money and invest it in women candidates very early in their campaigns so they can get rolling. But it's not overly rich. And, of course, there are a lot of women candidates who don't have the advantage of Emily's List. And Emily's List virtually always supports Democrats as well.
True, but they don't necessarily virtually always support women. They did support Lee Fisher over former Secretary of State, name slipping my mind, woman. What have you found, Aaron Velarde? I apologize for forgetting her name. What do you find with an organization like Emily's List? Is that the help they were hoping it would be?
I think Emily's List is fantastic, and it's pushed the conversation around women and money. Women's Campaign Forum also has a couple of good reports about largely the smaller amounts and the less frequency that women candidates get, also from male donors. You know, this is not just going into the sort of female coffers and saying, hey, let's fund our own campaigns. This is about asking some of the big guys to also step up and to write the same size checks and to max out. You know, on our end, we may often, on sort of the women's side, we may often ask for less. There are ways that we can always improve our fundraising skill. But I think you also find in some of these primaries that the faucets are not being turned on for women candidates in the same way. I'd love to see a study on that, actually, because I can feel it. I'm thinking of, you know, Sheryl Jackson's race a couple of years ago for Obama's senatorial seat. You know, only African-American woman in the race, you know, that was really the most federal level where I felt like the party is not putting the kind of resources in for women candidates in the primary. So there's a couple of things there where we have to ask bigger and expect bigger around these donors.
By the way, it's former Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner running against Lee Fisher. Sorry about that, Jennifer. Janet and Bexley are on the air. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Ann. I did a quick Google search because I knew there were some nations that mandate a balance of gender in their legislatures, and there are, according to this article in 2003, 45 nations where they have gender rules to have a greater representation of women. So unless we actually take this seriously, it's not that you just have to do all the grunt work. You should actually have mandates to have better balance in your legislatures. And there are some nations that have applied minority representation or ethnic groups as well. So it's not that these countries, Pakistan specifically or India, are doing things just women working harder. They actually mandate this in their legislatures.
And I would venture to guess some of those countries are also the ones that mandate a certain percentage of women on boards of directors of corporations and that sort of thing.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Okay. Janet, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Yep.
Aaron Velarde, once again, we're back to the sort of the system.
Absolutely. I'm not confident that we're going to pass a federal level or, national law around quotas in this country. What I do think we can do is, you know, look to the states, look to the local level to say, hey, you know, in your county party, are you making sure that you are, you know, talking to the party chair and asking the party chair to change some of the bylaws to make sure that there are, you know, 40% women in XYZ, whatever the sort of pockets of pools where they're looking at candidates. We need local women to hold their local parties accountable, to show some models for success,
The idea? No, I don't like to interrupt you. We're running out of time. I wanted to know, what about the issue of the growth of the independents and the independent movement in the United States? I mean, that means I don't identify with a party. Which party do I go to? How does that work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you for that softball, because VoteRunLead.org, that's exactly what we're trying to do. You know,
I wasn't a softball.
You know, it's exactly that, where we see young people, we see more, you know, diverse folks, women looking and going, I'm not really identifying wholeheartedly with either of these groups. I want to figure out my own politics.
Also, but how do you do that? Issues,
you got to educate yourself, right? You've got to figure out, you've got to go have conversations with people, you've got to be thoughtful about what your values are, have to do some of that soul searching. You know, you're looking for people to follow you when you go to public service. So do a little bit of that kind of emotional and mental search and saying, why am I the best person for this job? You know, this is my set of values. How do I come to these values? Being able to talk about that, get skilled on your communications, and, you know, getting your personal networks together so you can raise that money, and going out a little bit on a limb, because the parties for both men and women who have, you know, more broader and sort of diverser platforms aren't there, whether you're, you know, a white male or a woman of color. So if you're going to step outside of the box or be outside of the box or represent outside of the box, you might have to learn your political skills and build your civic resume in a different way. And technology really allows us to do that and to have access to really interesting people who are doing it, not just in the U.S., but all across the world.
Well, Aaron Velarde, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Erin Velarde, she's executive director of Vote Run Lead. It's a nonpartisan organization that trains women for civic leadership. And also Paul Beck, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne.
Paul Beck, political scientist, retired OSU professor. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby produced this show. Production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannan, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.